Chuck Klosterman is a New York Times bestselling author of novels and cultural essays, who's written for GQ, Esquire, Billboard, the AV Club, and served as a time as the New York Times Magazine's ethicist. His topics have varied widely, as well as you will discover in his latest book called Chuck Klosterman 10, A Highly Specific, Defiantly Incomplete History of the Early 21st Century, a collection of many of the pieces from the last decade. It's published by Blue Rider Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Klosterman back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You say that this is a collection of your nonfiction dreams.
I guess I did say that at one point, yes.
You know, the big problem is when you put things down on paper, people are going to ask you about what you
sure.
met later.
Well, you know, I do remember thinking, like, people will either think that I'm making fun of my own work or that I'm an incredibly pretentious person. And I suppose the reality is both of those things. I don't know.
Well, you say that your life is split into two halves.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, I guess it's like that joke. It's like the world is split into two groups of people, people who break the world into two halves and people who don't. What I was basically saying is that the content of this book, for the most part, is about either pop music or sports. There are other things in there, too. You know, there's stuff about film and television and, you know, peanuts and all these different things. But ultimately, most of this work is about sports and music, and that is kind of how my life sometimes feels split into, that I'm watching games and listening to music and just sort of thinking about it.
So we get Kobe Bryant, Jimmy Page, Zombies, Taylor Smith, Tim Tebow, now a minor league outfielder for a Mets team, Eddie Van Halen, Jonathan Franzen, a wide range of topics. Would you say these are reflections of your main interests, or do you have to be a Van Halen fan to write about Van Halen?
Well, it certainly helps. For the most part, writing about anything, if you're emotionally engaged with it, it's going to probably make you intellectually engaged too. I've been extremely lucky that sometime around the middle, you know, 2005, 2006, my career sort of moved from being a journalist who also writes books into being somebody who writes books and occasionally does journalism. And as a consequence, the only journalism I really do now are people or ideas that I'm very compelled by, which, you know, makes the job certainly more enriching or satisfying. But that's so the people that I profile in this book, for the most part, I was asked to do these profiles and I was like, yes, I will do this one. There are things about this individual that I personally want to know. And it's amazing that somehow my curiosity and this job sort of dovetails together.
One of the themes in the book is public image versus private image.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when you talk to famous people, people who suddenly become famous, as many of these did, that's something that they ponder over all the time.
Well, I think what's left for the journalist who talks to celebrities to do or to offer, right? Because the average consumer has so much access now to the idea of a celebrity or a famous person compared to how things had been in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So the one thing that you can sort of offer, I guess, is because you're sitting next to the individual, asking them questions directly, you can sort of try to find the difference between the brand they present, even if it's like, I'm not saying that they're just, this is all manufactured, but that's just the way a mediated culture works, that an individual's sort of personality becomes like a commodity, and then who the person actually is. And of course, they're aware of this too, and very often during the interview, they're aware you're trying to kind of figure this out, but I guess that's what I do for a living, you know?
Well, you're not the first person to interview any of these people.
Oh, of course not.
So you have to find certain things, strategies that others have not applied.
I think that another thing that I've been just really fortunate is a lot of the people I interview now are really sort of at the apex of their industry. They're not attempting to sort of reposition themselves. They're already these sort of mass individuals that the average person has sort of an understanding of. I am not that interested in many specific celebrities, but I am very interested by the concept of celebrity. And I think it's very interesting to talk to a famous person about that concept.
But despite that, your first piece, the one you say is the best you've ever published, is about a basketball game that has nothing to do with celebrity.
Yeah, well, that was something that had happened to me when I was a sophomore in high school. I went to a junior college basketball game with my older brother. And in the course of this game, one of the teams playing, which was from a tribal school, an all-Native American school, began the game with five players and two fouled out. And they finished the game playing 3-on-5, and they won this game. And it was this amazing event that was not televised. It was not even on the radio. I think there was only a few hundred people who saw it. And for many years, I wondered if maybe I had misremembered this event, that maybe I had made up this idea, this game, and it's, 'cause that happens. You sort of take your memories and you shape them to fit the reality you want. So when I started working at Grantland, when ESPN launched this site with Bill Simmons, the first story I wanted to do was to go back and sort of re-report this game to see if it actually happened and how close that was to my memory. And it was a complicated thing because I couldn't even find a box score for the game. It was this thing happened in North Dakota in this, it was a very desolate situation. It was hard to even find newspaper accounts of it. But
what about people who had participated?
That's who I ended up finding. But these people are also, not the easiest people to find. One of the best player was a guy named Barry Webster. But if all you know is that there was a guy named Barry Webster who went to this school, but I did find him. I found one guy, one of the players from the game. I was able to track him down because he still lives in North Dakota, and he's part of a horse club. And I found the webpage for their horse club, and it was, I wonder if this is the guy, and it was. But the reason that I enjoy doing that so much is that so much of what I write about is really disposable popular culture. I'm fully aware of that. I'm fully aware that anybody who's interested in my work is interested in something that they don't need but that they want.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this felt slightly different, though, because there were these, very strange, socioeconomic underpinnings to this story. The tribal school, they didn't even have warm-up pants. They traveled in a van. And, it was beyond sort of like the cliché David and Goliath situation. It was sort of like, it would be like if David didn't even have a slingshot. He didn't even have sweatpants.
If you're not a sports fan, you don't realize just how remarkable that feat is, three players beating five players. You inject yourself into these pieces. You decided not as a journalist to do the objective approach?
That's an interesting question because I worked in newspapers all through the 90s. So I still perceive myself as someone who values objective journalism more than most of the people I seem to encounter in my industry now. Now there seems to be sort of this belief that because objectivity is impossible, there's no need to even try to create this illusion. You should just put your biases straight forward. But I think that's really been negative for the culture. This might be an arrogant thing, but I feel as though that one thing that I have sort of been trained to do over time is to be very conscious of your biases and compensate for them. I mean, that's, you'll never be perfectly objective, but the idea is to get as close as possible, and that's how you do it. That said, I do put myself in these stories sometimes, but mainly because there are situations when it's just the most effective, efficient way to get information across. Sometimes I feel like it's just easier to say, look, I was there, this is what was happening, and this is how it felt. If you don't believe me, you don't believe me, but I'm trying to tell you the way it felt as a detached person.
You opened one of these pieces by telling the story of how you once told a stranger, "I manufacture opinions."
Yeah, I was in Amsterdam.
Were you bragging?
Well, I was in Amsterdam talking to this guy, and he was telling me about his life. We were actually in a hash bar when this was happening, and he had this bad speech impediment, and he was telling me about being a house painter and all these family troubles. And then he asked me what I did, and it was during a period in my life when I was kind of depressed, and it seemed really idiotic to me that my whole life seemed to be around, you know, watching a movie or listening to a record and then trying to convince or persuade people that sort of my relationship with it is was somehow. So I was like, I told the guy, like, I manufacture opinions. And he said, like, well, how do you know if you're good at it? And I was like, well, if a whole bunch of people agree or a whole bunch of people disagree, there seems to be a sense I was good at it. Like,
And do you feel that's been the case?
Well, I feel that's how media operates in the world of sort of opinion creation and criticism, in a sense. I mean, one thing that has really been changed by the internet is because there is now so much criticism, the only way to have any traction whatsoever is to be on the most bombastic poll. And I mean, obviously, I don't like that, but I don't think anyone likes that. Yeah.
Well, did it work that way when you were the ethicist at the New York Times?
I think that maybe in retrospect now, when I look back on it, I was very openly trying to get away from that, thinking that I would move into this thing where instead of my personality somehow driving the conclusion, it would be these other things. You know, that was just a, you know, I loved doing that job. I you know, but I at one point I realized, like, I wanted to be great at this and I'm just okay.
We liked it.
It was a hard job to do well. Very easy job to do poorly, but it was a hard job to do well.
Chuck Klosterman is here to talk about his latest book, which is Chuck Klosterman 10, or Chuck Klosterman with an X, standing for 10, obviously. How many of them are fiction? How many nonfiction?
Well, okay, there's 10 books. 2 are novels, 2 are anthologies, and 6 are nonfiction.
The reason I ask about that is you profiled Tom Brady regarding Deflategate, mm-hmm. the whole matter of fiction and nonfiction. It didn't go all that well. Did avoiding questions make Brady seem guilty? Because hadn't you been assured by his manager that he was open to talking about the situation?
Yeah, well, that's – and the nice thing about doing a compilation like this is that I could kind of add this preface explaining what actually happened. Tom Brady was going to be GQ's Man of the Year, and they asked me if I wanted to interview him. And I was like, sure, but there's only really one thing I want to ask him about. I mean, everything else will kind of unspool from that, but – This issue of Deflategate, I just felt like was the central thing about his identity at the time. So they come back and they tell me, yes, one of his managers has said, not only is Tom Brady going to talk about this, like, this interview is going to, like, shake up the world. It's like I was like, wow, what's he going to say, you know? And then another point, I was going to meet him in Boston, and then I was told, well, no, he doesn't even want to look you in the eye when he has this conversation. I was like, so what's this going to be? But then when I actually spoke with him, either A, he had no intention whatsoever of talking about any of this, or B, he had no idea this was going to be brought up. I mean, it's very possible that he had never been informed of this. But, you know, the way magazines work, it's like the photos had already been taken. He was already going to be on the cover of the magazine. He was going to be Man of the Year, even if he didn't give any interview. So then it became the situation, well, how do you deal with this? So essentially, I wrote an essay about Tom Brady, and in the middle, I included the section where I asked him pretty much the same question over and over again, and he kept saying, I'm not going to talk about it. And like, now, does that reflect anything about him? I think it does. I think in some ways it reflects more than if he had given an orchestrated answer. But, you know, it wasn't a successful interview in that he did not answer the question.
In one of your more off-the-wall pieces, you created a statistical system similar to baseball's VORP in regard to musicians. You call it VORM. What is that?
Okay. Back when I had mentioned this thing about Grantland, we're starting this site for ESPN, and it's a real fusion of sports and culture, popular culture and stuff. And Bill Simmons, who runs the site, he always is looking for ways to think about art as if it's sports. Like, is there a way we can statistically track the Oscars or whatever? So there's this statistic in baseball, like value over replacement player, VORP. The idea of how good is a player compared to the most average guy were he to replace him, you know, in the lineup. So Bill was wondering, could we do this for music? Can we somehow create a way to track the value of, you know, you know, how valuable was Mick Taylor to the Rolling Stones compared to Ron Wood? How valuable is Morrissey to the Smiths? You know, all of these things. And I was like, well, that's impossible. In fact, it's kind of moronic, but let me try. So I tried to come up with this way of doing it, and it's like two things. In one way, it's sort of a commentary on how insane it is to look at art as if it's this completely objective thing. And on the other hand, it's like, well, the math is fun to work, though. Like, the math actually kind of works if this wasn't a terrible idea.
But a lot of what you're writing about might be considered disposable art.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about Caravaggio here. And I was just in a shop the other day, and in the background they were playing a Whiter Shade of Pale. And I asked the young sales clerk, this is a generational thing, but do you have any idea who this is? She said, well, I think I heard the song once. Now, when that was a big hit, everybody knew who Procol Harum was. Mm. Well, I could go through a list of the people you've written about. Do you think that these pieces will have much meaning in the future? Or do you think that because you really go into these things in great depth to the point where some wonder whether you might be even overthinking, that they will have some kind of quality that goes beyond the disposable aspect?
Well, that's a great question. Okay. For the most part, all culture, popular otherwise, is disposable for the mass, okay, for society as a whole. But like, you use Procol Harum as an example. Now, are they still something that the average 23-year-old music fan has much interest or relationship to? No. Okay. But you're not necessarily, when you're doing culture and you're thinking about it historically, you're not really thinking about that average person. You're thinking about that fringe person who is really interested in the past and who, for the most part, are the kind of people who become cultural critics and who become curators of this thing. So now, if there was a really interesting feature about that song written at the time of its release, and I'm sure there's probably one out there, you know, probably in some, you know, early issue of Rolling Stone or Crawdaddy or something, to that person, that unusual person, reading that piece might be incredibly important. So, like, am I certain that in 100 years people are going to care about Pavement and Stephen Milkmus, you know, across the board? I don't think that they will, but I think it's possible that some people might. And at the same time, you know, I don't know if it's possible to write nonfiction with the idea that this still has to be useful in 100 years. Fiction, you can maybe think that way if you're really confident.
Are you working on another novel?
I'm working on a project that is fiction but not a novel.
Chuck Klosterman will be giving a talk and signing copies of his new book tomorrow night at the Ace Hotel. That's at 20 West 29th Street. Doors open at 7. Ticket information on our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. The book, Chuck Klosterman 10, is published by Blue Rider Press. Thanks for being back with us today.
Thanks a lot.